Our next case is 13-580. We'll wait for our justices to We are here on case 13-580, Mary Lou Burkhart versus H.J. Hines Company et al. We have sitting for Justice Lansinger, 8th District Court of Appeals, Judge Melody Stewart. Welcome, Judge Stewart. And for the appellant here, we have Mr. Savage.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. In this asbestos appeal, I would like the court to note that there is a significant difference between the elements of proof for a tort plaintiff bringing a claim against asbestos manufacturers and suppliers than there is in a workers' compensation plaintiff bringing a claim against an employer. The distinction is this. In the tort plaintiff's case, the plaintiff must establish not only the exposure to the asbestos and the proximate cause to the injury, but the plaintiff must also establish that there has been exposure to a specific manufacturer's product and that that exposure was a substantial contribution to the injury, or in this case, the death. In a workers' compensation case, however, the plaintiff need only show an injurious exposure at the employer's work site, proximately causing the injury.
Well, I thought in the asbestos cases, a whole range of defendants got brought in because it was impossible to know whose asbestos was in the was being used, was on the walls or was being put in the boiler of the locomotive or that kind of thing. Is that wrong?
If I understood your Honor's question, I believe it is wrong, yes. Okay. We don't have enterprise liability in this state. And the case of Horton versus Hardwick Chemical, decided by this court back in 1995, stands for the proposition that there must be proof of a specific exposure to a specific supplier or defendant's product. And that is why the discovery process between these two types of cases proceeds much differently.
But here we're talking about a deposition given by the decedent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's in there that would be lacking if you'd been able to cross-examine them?
There is testimony in the deposition in question by the decedent that while he was employed by my client in the early years, he was using a bucket of material that was wet that he was informed contained asbestos that he then proceeded to place on pipe. That testimony was completely unchallenged, both as to form, the basis, nor was it cross-examined.
And was it wrong? Is that?
Well, we have the plaintiffs.
You can prove that that's not what he did.
The testimony was referring to events that happened in the very distant past, probably right after World War II or in the early 1950s, and that is the whole point.
I'm not sure that is the whole point. Didn't the plaintiff in this matter just bear the burden of demonstrating that he was exposed to asbestos in the workplace?
He did.
Clearly, your clients would contest whether or not that statement was challenged, whether it was worthy of belief, but how does it get stricken?
How does it what?
The statement of a decedent, how does that just get stricken when they're trying to decide, was he or was he not exposed to asbestos? Isn't his belief as a maintenance man entitled to some weight?
What is the basis for admitting that testimony, however, Your Honor?
Belief of the claimant.
But it's not in this case. It's testimony in another case. That's the point that I'm trying to get to.
Yes, but he's dead.
Yes, he is.
So therefore, something he said in the past is not going to come from him. And isn't it relevant in a workers' compensation case for a claimant to say, I got a bucket of white stuff that I believe to be asbestos, and now I have mesothelioma?
It is not admissible under the hearsay rules. That is the problem with that testimony.
Why?
Because we were not a party to that case, and those that were not of a similar situated motivation to inquire.
What was different?
That's a good question. In the asbestos case, the defense lawyers are interested in protecting their particular client.
So this is the tort case. The tort case, let's call it the tort case and the, what do you want to call the second one? The workers' comp case.
Sure.
Okay, so in the tort case, he's taking a deposition. The allegation is asbestos.
That's correct. And in the depositions in question, there were as many as 40 defendants, as much as 25 lawyers. In the deposition that is being sought to be introduced, Your Honor, one lawyer cross-examined, and he only cross-examined because his client's name had unexpectedly come up during the course of that deposition. He cried foul and said, I want a discovery deposition. They gave him a discovery deposition, and he went back and crossed on that and said, isn't it true, Mr. Witness, you don't know if my client's product contained asbestos? And the witness said, yes. That was the entire extent of the cross-examination from 25 lawyers in that room.
Counselor, let me ask this. If indeed those defendants in that litigation, if there's a question of whether their products had asbestos in it, weren't all these products in Mr. Burkhart's workplace?
No.
The piping, the questions that were being asked for the product's liability for the asbestos.
Well, when an asbestos case is filed, Your Honor, they name a whole cast of suspects.
Okay.
Happens oftentimes that there is not a proof to establish that, in fact, there was exposure to that particular client's product. The case management order from the Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Court provides a time for these defendants to come forward and file motions for summary judgment on lack of what we call product identification.
So out of the 25 asbestos manufacturers that were in the room questioning the decedent at the time about a asbestos tort action, nobody could point to the ABC Asbestos Company as being the manufacturer of the asbestos that was in the bucket that was utilized by the decedent.
Absolutely.
Okay. But is there anybody that is testifying in this workers' comp that this decedent was not exposed to asbestos and thereby contracted the mesothelioma?
There would be a testimony from the employer, had the case gone to trial and summary judgment not been granted, that it was unlikely that he would have been exposed to asbestos.
Because the employer didn't use asbestos products in the factory?
Both. In some situations, they did not use it, or it was used in an encapsulated manner, or he was not involved in work activity that would lead him to be exposed to it. Bear in mind, this gentleman served in the U.S. Marine Corps and Navy on board ships in World War II. He worked in his father's garage. He had worked very briefly as a construction contractor. There were other points in his life that could have exposed him to asbestos.
So that means he may not prevail, but is the only proposition of law before this court is whether the Sixth District properly reversed the decision to allow, I guess under Lloyd and the Paducah cases, to allow the deposition testimony to be admitted as predecessor in interest.
It is.
So it's just that sole proposition of law. Of all the other evidentiary issues that the Sixth Circuit reversed on the trial court are still reversed.
Well, we assign those as error, but unfortunately, this court only accepted
jurisdiction. Right, but before this court only is the videotaped deposition,
that's right,
correct?
That's right.
So the question is, we under the case law, is there sufficient indicia that makes it clear that your client was not a party in the products liability case?
Well, that's uncontroverted.
That's uncontroverted. But can the other defendants be predecessors in interest?
I didn't catch the last part.
Can the other defendants be predecessors in interest to your client?
Absolutely not. First of all, they're not in any legal sense.
But everybody was defending against mesothelioma brought about by asbestos.
Let me put a sharper point, if I could. Let's assume that each of you are representing a defendant in that case. And you hear this testimony, and not one of your clients are named. It doesn't come up in the entire deposition. What motivation would you have to cross-examine the witness about that? Actually, you'd probably be foolish to ask any questions because you're better off to let that testimony go, because you can go to the court and say there is no evidence that my client's product was used.
But the testimony, at least the excerpts that we have, did indicate exposure or whether the products or whether Mr. Burkhart was exposed in his workplace. He talks about his work, his job, the pipes. He talks about the white substance. He talks about management told him it was asbestos.
He does, but he doesn't talk about what type of product it was. So if Your Honor represents the ABC Corporation and you're sitting there listening to that testimony, you're going to say, well, it doesn't harm me a bit. I'm not even going to make it worse by asking a question, because he might come forward and say, well, yes, I remember that came from the ABC Corporation. You have no motivation to cross-examination. You have a motivation to keep silent. However, the attorneys for the employer in that situation would be motivated to go at that testimony to find out what was the basis
Counsel,
of it.
Counsel, did the employer have notice of that deposition?
No, and they theoretically they could have. Understand that the plaintiff obviously was alive at the time of the testimony, but he filed no workers' compensation claim. He had retired from us 20 years previously. Filed his Cuyahoga County suit in 2006. He passed away in 2007. He could have filed a workers' compensation claim.
Well, I guess the direct question I have is the record very clear that this employer did not know of the existence of that deposition?
That is absolutely clear, Your Honor. Absolutely clear.
Well, the employer wouldn't be named in the tort action at all.
Of course not.
Because it'd be a product.
But I suppose there could be ways. If you filed the workers' compensation, you claim you could use the testimony that way, or perhaps if you filed some sort of a case to perpetuate his testimony, which is what they were doing with this last deposition. But the employer was not a party to it all.
So to pick up on Judge Stewart's question, Evidence Rule 804B1 says the following are not excluded by the hearsay rule. And they talk about the former testimony where a predecessor in interest had the opportunity and similar motive to develop the testimony by direct, cross, or redirect examination. But I understand your argument is those individuals who were present had no similar motive or interest. Well, I guess, first of all, you're saying they weren't predecessors in interest, and even if they were, they had no similar motive to develop testimony by a cross to contradict what was said.
Exactly. And not only did they not have a motive, one could argue that they would be deviating from the appropriate standard of care for raising something that might backfire on them. In cross-examination, as you all know, the first question is, do you ask any questions? And so in these discovery depositions where the plaintiffs sit there with these battery of lawyers out there, the first question is, should I even ask that question? And most people err on,
if
I'm
we,
not going to ask.
What are you asking us to do or write in this case? It seems pretty factually specific because it's really regulated to one case and one specific application of evidence rule 804.
I don't think
so. Where a party is, where a deposition is being offered and the person that's being offered against hasn't had an opportunity to cross-examine.
Well, that's true, but that's obviously what the rule is intended, to carve out those certain exceptions where that is permissible. This is a very unusual case where an appellate court dings a trial court for abusing its discretion on an evidentiary issue, which I find unusual. But this happens a lot, as indicated by the amicus brief of the Ohio Manufacturers Association, where employers are often faced with testimony in a case that they have not been a part of to bring before the Industrial Commission, where the rules of evidence don't apply, and then into a courtroom where the rules of evidence do apply to be used to establish the elements of a compensable workers' compensation claim.
Mr.
It's
Savage,
a problem in this case.
Let me ask this real quick, because I see you're running out of time. There's always, I would venture to say, going to be counsel who say, we weren't parties, that testimony can't be used against us. And argue they weren't predecessors and interests. So what example could you give where 804B would apply to your client who was not a party, but is a predecessor, is the same, that the testimony could be admissible?
There are a number of, first of all, the federal courts seem to blend the distinction. They make predecessor and interest to mean someone had an opportunity and motive. The amicus brief, I think, very well points out that that's probably a slippery slope to go down, and it makes the whole rule senseless to have those two conditions in there. So there are many times where there might be a similar motive. Let's say the employer was not a defendant in this case, and we're just talking about an asbestos case. So one of the defense lawyers for the defense company is not a party to the case at that particular time. They are later amended in an amendment. At least you might argue that they're all asbestos manufacturer defendants with similar motivations. But in a workers' compensation setting, the motivation is completely different. The other lawyers can sit there idly by when all they hear about this asbestos testimony. And it doesn't matter to them if it doesn't name their client. If it names somebody else's client, that's great. In today's world of apportionment of liability, you're happy to hear that kind of stuff. But if you're in the employer's counsel, you have to go after all such testimony. And my client never had that opportunity. I think I've consumed my time.
You have. Thank you. Mr. Grunda?
Chief Justice O'Connor, if it may please the court. The sole issue for review before this honorable court is whether or not the deposition of Donald Burkhart, given while he was still alive, can be used in the trial of his surviving spouse's workers' compensation claim. These are for death benefits for the surviving spouse. This is a claim that can only be brought after the Mr. Burkhart, who was the plaintiff in those tort actions we've been speaking about, has passed away.
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand procedurally. Are you saying an asbestos claim was not filed on his behalf during his lifetime?
No, there was a case filed on his behalf during his lifetime. I'm saying that the workers' compensation claim is actually the claim of his surviving spouse.
I understand. I'm talking about workers' compensation.
No, there was not a workers' compensation.
So he never filed for workers' comp as a result of contracting asbestos in the workplace?
No, he did not. No, there was never anything filed while he was alive. As this court is aware from reading the opinion of the Sixth District, Mrs. Burkhart had numerous pieces of evidence that established her husband was exposed to asbestos at Hines. Mr. Burkhart's deposition is only one piece of that evidence. And I also like to state that nowhere in Hines' assignment of error or at any other point in their briefing do they argue that the summary judgment decision of the Sixth District should be reversed. So the only issue is when this case goes to trial, should Mr. Burkhart's deposition be admitted into evidence in addition to the other evidence? As was stated by opposing counsel, this situation happens quite often where defendants and plaintiffs, in asbestos cases in particular, will try to introduce former testimony. And we believe it's important, and we encourage this court, that they do come up with some type of test or guidelines for plaintiffs, defendants, in the application of Evidence Rule 804B1.
Counselor, are you proposing that we use the Lloyd test?
We do believe that the Lloyd test is a good test and that it was properly decided.
Could you respond then to your opponent's argument that the Lloyd test really collapses the two elements together, that the predecessor in interest is defined as someone who has a similar motive? How does that really give rise, or how does it really give life to 804? If we're collapsing those two criteria?
Lloyd, along with later courts looking in the Sixth Circuit, and that those would be the Clay Court, Burke, Murphy, Dykes, when looking at the test, the best way they determine to understand what the predecessor of interest is by combining it with that second part of 804B1, which is, you know, had an opportunity and similar motive to develop the testimony.
So is there ever a predecessor in interest that doesn't have a similar motive?
Yes, I would say yes. I mean, and you see that through the cases. There are instances where, maybe I misunderstood. Is there ever a predecessor in interest who doesn't have a similar motive? I would say in general, no. Not in a situation like this.
Then why would 804 be written the way that it is?
If you look at the Lloyd case and they examine the procedural history of 804B1, and they actually look at the notes from the committee rules, and in the intent of 804B1, they state in the Lloyd case, it was originally designed by the Advisory Committee on Rules of Evidence of the Judicial Conference of the United States to strike a proper balance between the recognized risk of introducing testimony of one not physically present on the witness stand and the equally recognized risk of denying to the fact finder important relevant evidence.
But you would agree, would you not, that we're not bound by that? That here we're talking about state law, and we wouldn't necessarily be bound by what the federal courts say the federal rules mean.
No, that's absolutely true. We're dealing here with the Ohio Rules of Evidence. However, the Ohio Rule 804B1 is written exactly the same as the federal Rule 804B1. And I definitely believe it's the case that 804B1 and the cases that have interpreted on the federal level are very instructive of how that rule should be applied.
Do we need to define predecessor in interest in this case?
No more so than I think that the Lloyd case already has defined it and how they define it.
So you subscribe to this community of interest?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, we believe that the Lloyd test, and if I may, you know, where they stay, you know, while we do not endorse an extravagant interpretation of who or what constitutes a predecessor in interest, we prefer one that is realistically generous over one that is formalistically grudging. We believe that what has been described as the practical and expedient view expresses the congressional intention. If it appears that the former suit a party having a like motive to cross-examine about the same matters as the present party would have was accorded an adequate opportunity for such examination, the testimony may be received against the present party.
So stop right there. You think that the attorneys that were present, the 25 attorneys with only one doing the cross-examining, would have at that point in their cross-examination delved into the circumstances of asbestos use at the Heinz factories?
Absolutely, Your Honor. First, we have to...
Where in the deposition does it show that?
Well, I think the key here is partly to see that this deposition didn't happen in a vacuum. It was preceded by three volumes of discovery deposition conducted by the defendants in that same tort case, I believe approximately 5.5 hours, where 9 different defendants asked questions.
But you will agree, will you not, that of the 25 lawyers were there, they really had no motive to say, well, if you were exposed, you were exposed during World War II in the shipyard. That wouldn't have helped their case at all. Whereas the employer's case, it sounds to me to be their critical defense, and they weren't there.
I believe that's a false proposition, Your Honor.
Why?
Because their motive under a number of circumstances is the same as Hines. I mean, first we got to understand, first motive is, for all these defendants, is to demonstrate that there was no exposure.
You weren't exposed at all.
He wasn't exposed at all. That's
not necessarily their role. Their role is to say, you may have been exposed, but I've never done business with Hines.
Right.
And so I'm the manufacturer, and I only sell asbestos on the West Coast. And this fellow worked in Fremont and another part, a factory in Ohio. I've never sold asbestos to Hines Company. And neither have 12 other of us. So we need to be dismissed here.
And the other 12 of us didn't have a product in any of these plants.
And see, Your Honor, there's where, and that's the false proposition here. Because I guess, you know, if we went to the extreme, we never sold anything outside of California and we were mom and pop in San Francisco, and why are we sued at all? I could see that situation. These people, these defendants weren't sued in that kind of, you know, bubble. They were sued because there was the possibility that, you know, Mr. Burkhart was exposed while working at Hines to their product. Now,
they were selected because they dealt with Hines, or they were selected because they were asbestos manufacturers?
Both. I mean, it would have to be both. I mean, one asbestos manufacturer, but also because we had a good faith reason to believe that they may have done business with Hines, or there may have been some connection between Mr. Burkhart and their product, either at Hines or possibly somewhere else, but that there would be the possibility. What we're running into here is the fact that just because Mr. Burkhart did not remember the name of a product doesn't get that product manufacturer off the hook.
No, there's plenty of other opportunities to examine sales records and company records, and you're saying that was all done here on behalf of Mr. Burkhart, and it was shown that there was asbestos in the Hines factory.
Absolutely. I mean, and even those defendants, they have to work under the proposition that if Mr. Burkhart says, I believe I was exposed to asbestos from pipes or from pipe insulation or from valves or from working with pumps, that even though that Mr. Burkhart did not know who that manufacturer was, that there's the possibility that a coworker may testify at a later point, and he may know who that manufacturer was.
But counsel, don't we have to look at the motive? And now I think I'm hearing your other side. There isn't one lawyer that was at that deposition who would want to just go at him and say, you were exposed to asbestos in the shipyard. No one would have a motive to say, you were exposed.
Actually, they would, particularly when we talk about...
If they didn't have any products in the shipyard, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And now we get to RC 2307.2, the Apportionment of Liability Act. The more defendants that every one of those defendants has the motivation to get as many other defendants on the verdict form or to get as many other defendants some share of liability in order to decrease their own possible share of liability.
But the core of this case is that Hines was the employer and wasn't a party to the tort case. So one of the ways to win a case is to point to the empty chair and put it on Hines. And if they do that, to the extent that's done, there is no community of interest. And I think that was what I was hearing from Mr. Savage in the course of developing his argument. Number one, we're not a predecessor in interest because it doesn't fit And two, there is no community of interest.
And that's why I think we're wrong, because those other defendants created that community of interest. I don't think there's any evidence that they were pointing at any point that someone pointed their fingers and said, oh, it was Hines. And with apportionment, you know, everyone, you want to, every defendant has a, should have the duty to point to many, as many defendants as possible in order to limit their own. You know, and another thing is they keep on saying, you know, this comes down to motive. What they're arguing is that we're not a predecessor in interest because we didn't have the motive or a similar interest to develop, you know, they didn't have the same motive or similar interest to develop this testimony. Well, then the question becomes then, why has Hines kept on using this testimony themselves? Why did they go and were the first to actually bring up this deposition testimony in their motion for summary judgment at the trial court?
Do you agree with Mr. Savage, if we go to the other word, which is opportunity, that this was a total surprise to the employer that there had been a deposition of their employee who was dying?
This isn't their opportunity. I mean, the rule isn't speaking of them having the opportunity. It's about the people at the deposition, those other, in this case, those other 25 defendants having the opportunity to ask questions. That's what
I guess I'm expanding the rule just to ask you the direct question. Is there anything indicating that they knew there was a deposition about to happen and they should have known a workers' comp case was coming and they should have been there? Did they have notice?
As far as I know, they did not. But again, we only handled the workers' compensation side of it. But as far as I know, they did not have notice.
Counsel, are you saying that with all those, the 25 defendants there and the questions that were being asked of Mr. Burkhart, that regardless of what evidence was elicited, if there's a determination that there was asbestos products or asbestos in some of those, let's say half of the defendants, that all those products were in the workplace in Hines at either one of the plants, and so by deduction, he got it in the workplace, regardless of whether he could name the manager who said, or the management that said it was asbestos, whether it was in the piping, whether it was in the ceiling tiles. Is that your contention?
Exactly. I think a good example of this came in the Dykes case, when they were reviewing the testimony from Dr. Kenneth Smith, who worked for Johns Manville. And this is a whole series of cases, Clay, Murphy, Dykes from the Sixth Circuit. And in those cases, they were examining whether or not Dr. Smith's testimony should come in or not. And one of the reasons they allowed it to come in the Dykes case is, as they said in the opinion here, the testimony of Dr. Smith is not so much a testimony of any expert who is giving opinions as it is testimony of a very knowledgeable person who was aware of the historical development of the specialized subject matter under examination. And in some ways, that's the exact same kind of thing we have here. Who knows better what happened to Mr. Burkhart while working at Hines than Mr. Burkhart? But
even in his testimony, he says, well, it was white dust or was this, it was asbestos. Well, I think it's asbestos, so that's what they told me.
And
you say, who knows what happened better than Mr. Burkhart? Mr. Burkhart doesn't seem to be exactly sure.
Well, he explained the reason why he believed it was, because management had told him. And then you get into the fact, as the Sixth District found in their opinion in this case, that becomes then an issue of fact for the jury to decide.
At least to be admissible for purposes of summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. Also, the fact that this is a workers' compensation claim, one of the cases cited by appellant in their brief was Industrial Commission of Ohio versus Bartholm. And this is a 1934 Supreme Court case from this Ohio Supreme Court. And obviously this is before the rules of civil procedure. However, one of the statements I think is important here, and this is about whether or not testimony that was given during by the decedent during an industrial commission hearing should be allowed to be used against the employer after he died and the wife brought a death claim. And one of the things they stated in there is, we enter this realm of discussion bearing in mind that all the law relating directly or indirectly to the right of employers to participate in the workers' compensation fund must be liberally construed to the end that the purposes for which the fund was created may be subserved. And here I believe that's, you know, very telling along in this case and the facts of this case, that this is a workers' compensation claim, and that, you know, I believe that the Sixth District did find properly that the testimony taken in the tort action did create a community of interest that is, you know, similar enough with enough motive that same testimony can be used in this case against Hines. And who better to give testimony about what he did, where he worked, his exposures, or what happened to him at Hines than Mr. Burkhart himself?
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
I just came to retrieve my watch, actually. But this is a very important case because it involves the basic right of confrontation. The reason why there were 25 lawyers in the room on those depositions is because they all had conflicts of interest. They could not have represented one, and they certainly couldn't have represented the employer at the same time. So having that conflict of interest, they were constrained in what they could ask the witness to properly address and represent the clients that they were there to represent. I think that it's a slippery slope to go down to start interpreting this rule in a manner that it can be used against employers. While we have liberal construction of the workers' compensation statutes under the statutory scheme, we don't have liberal construction of the rules of evidence for the same reason. The application by the Sixth Appellate District violates this rule. Whether you want to use a community of interest approach or whether you want to strictly say that there was no predecessor in interest, it violates both. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.